Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. When I used to work for Congressman Barney Frank, I was his legislative counsel more than 10 years ago now, actually, more like 15 years ago. It was in the early O's. It was right after, actually before and after September 11th. And I remember when the United States decided to go to war against Iraq. I was very much opposed to that war. I thought it was not smart. I also thought it was about oil and not about September 11th because, well, Saddam Hussein had no role in September 11th whatsoever. I did support the war in Afghanistan, although certainly now I think it's gone on way too long, but I did think we needed to punish the people who murdered 3,000 Americans. But I thought two wars seemed to me to be, well, at the very least unnecessary, and at the worst, of course, a needless loss of life, American lives, and of course, Iraqi lives. The other thing, though, the part that got very little attention, I think, during the war in Iraq, those for it, those against it, I remember very few people discussing what impact it would have in the rest of the world. And I remember very clearly in 01, 02, 03, as North Korea started to develop nuclear weapons. In fact, I remember talking to constituents on the phone saying, 60 more days, 90 more days till North Korea develops nuclear weapons. And marveling at how the George Bush administration that talked so tough was doing nothing. You may recall that under the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton made a deal that many Republicans criticized at the time, but it was a deal to monitor North Korea to prevent it from establishing nuclear weapons. We would give them some food aid, and in return, we had cameras to make sure they didn't develop nuclear weapons. But North Korea and its dictator at the time, Kim Jong-il, recognized that with the America fighting two wars, it didn't have time to worry about North Korea. It certainly didn't have any focus on North Korea. And I remember very clearly when North Korea decided in 01, 02, 03 to shut off the cameras, to kick the inspectors out, and to go full scale ahead with their nuclear program. Now, that would have been a convenient time to do something. A convenient time to have very tough sanctions, a convenient time to say they broke the deal and go to the United Nations and, well, punish them severely. Maybe even consider, if necessary, threatening military action to stop them from developing nuclear weapons. But hey, how could we do that? We were involved in two wars at the time. We had just gone to war, claiming Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction when he didn't have them. And side point, there's only one weapon of mass destruction, folks. I hate that term. George Bush administration developed it. It's not a real term. It's not a real thing. It has no value in the law. He did it in order to lump together biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. Well, I have a dirty little secret. Biological and chemical weapons, they're not nice, and they're not pleasant. But really, they're not that much more damaging. In fact, many times they're less damaging than conventional explosives. Chemical weapons used by Syria against its own people have killed some 5,000 innocent Syrians. It's a terrible thing. But conventional weapons in Syria have been used by the dictator Assad to murder 400,000 people. Again, I'm no fan of biological and chemical weapons. They're certainly very easy for terrorists to get a hold of. But for a nation state, the fact that Iraq might have had biological or chemical weapons, to me, wasn't that important. What mattered was, were they using it against their own citizens? And in 2002, they were not. The most important thing is Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons. I never felt it was appropriate to lump in together biological and chemical weapons capable, yes, of killing thousands, with nuclear weapons capable of killing hundreds of thousands or millions. Again, not defending biological or chemical weapons, but there's an order of magnitude difference between their power and the power of nuclear weapons. So while George Bush was busy fighting an ultimately useless war in Iraq, an ultimately counterproductive war in Iraq, a war that destabilized the Middle East, a war that didn't bring that much freedom to the people of Iraq, a war that I don't think brought American oil companies that much more oil either, didn't really do much. While we were fighting that war, North Korea, a far more dangerous dictator than Saddam Hussein, breached the treaty that Bill Clinton had carefully crafted. George Bush did nothing about it, and they went to establish their nuclear weapons. Lately, of course, they've been establishing missiles, missiles that we now know can reach the United States. Indeed, at first we thought they could just reach Alaska, and then it became the West Coast, and now it appears to be pretty much all of us are in the path of the missile, and sources tell us they can put a nuclear warhead, a miniaturized nuclear warhead, in the missile. It's pretty scary. And what is our president doing about it in his vacation time in New Jersey? Well, he hasn't put much initial thought into it. He didn't discuss anything with his generals or his staff. He just blurted out, arms crossed, they're going to find fire and fury if they attack us like the world has never seen. Which sounds pretty harsh. Of course, like the world has never seen has been Trump's mantra for about 100 different things, he said. So it's a very common catchphrase for him. And it would help if anyone took the president seriously. But no one does. His own staff doesn't take him seriously, and they said so. They said that he was doing a opioid crisis discussion, and he wasn't planning to talk about North Korea, and he gave no one any warning before he said that. His generals were quick to tamp down discussion of war, even though it seemed like Donald Trump was arguing that he was ready to win a nuclear war. His officials were saying, there's been no change in policy. We didn't know he was going to say this. Don't take the president seriously, was the subtext. We know our allies don't take the president seriously. In fact, they laugh at us, they mock us, as they establish other ways to lead the free world. Recognize the United States, because of our president, can no longer be a leader of the free world. France and England and Japan and Germany and other strong Western countries are working together to go on without us. I think once the United States left the Paris Accord, it was pretty much established. We were no longer the leader of the free world. They would go on without us. But meanwhile, they mock the president. Even people whose leader's first language isn't English are mocking the president's English. Ooh, that's gotta hurt. Imagine, it's your second language, and yet you speak it better than the president of the United States. In fact, some diplomats, foreign diplomats, were playing Trump bingo. And what it is you go and you fill out your card and you write incredible, great, amazing, best the world has ever seen. And you get so many phrases in a row and you get bingo. Of course, the trouble was everyone was winning way too often. Maybe that's what Trump meant when he said you're going to get so tired of winning. He's so repetitive and his ideas have so little value that he just repeats, great, stupendous, tremendous. Much like, you know, an 8-year-old might, except I think most 8-year-olds will have better self-control. That doesn't mean North Korea is not a real problem. North Korea is a real problem. It just means that we're leaderless in dealing with it. Our president is going to say anything, and it won't mean anything because no one will know what it means. His own party is saying that now. John McCain said that he's tired of trying to figure out what Donald Trump means, and he never knows what he means anyway, so he's given up. When a member of your own party, a leading member of your own party, basically says any presidential pronouncement is worthless, that's a bad sign. The American people don't believe Donald Trump either, as his opinion ratings are down to 33%. Less than a quarter of Americans, or 24%, believe a majority of what they hear out of the White House. I want you to think about that. As much as I've disliked other presidents, as much as I believed other presidents have misstated the truth from time to time, tweaked things a bit, perhaps, I can't recall a president where I disbelieved the majority of things that they said. I'm too young to really remember Richard Nixon. But, there are certainly presidents I disliked. I just mentioned George W. Bush. But when I say a majority of the things he said were untrue, I don't know that I'd say that. And yet more than three quarters of Americans say a majority of things coming out of the White House are untrue. In fact, I believe it's closer to 90%. But more than three quarters of Americans say a majority is untrue. Note that there's a little bit of a gap there. 24% of Americans believe at least a majority of what the president says, less than a quarter, 24%, and yet 33% still approve of him. That means 9%, or about a quarter of his followers, don't believe a majority of what he says, but still approve of him. And of course, two-thirds of us disapprove, and more than three-quarters believe a majority of what he says are lies. So the American people don't trust him. His own generals don't trust him. His own party doesn't trust him. Certainly the opposition party doesn't trust him. His own staff doesn't trust him. They keep trying to wrestle that Twitter away from him, but he won't do it. Even his new chief of staff, Kelly, General Kelly, can't get it away from him. Foreigners don't believe him, whether it be foreign leaders or foreign peoples. In fact, they joke about if you want what you need from Donald Trump, all you have to do is butter him up, compliment him a few times, and you get what you want. That's how Vladimir Putin gets what he wants. And we know that his aides have decided that a one-pager is too much, too taxing for Donald Trump. Maybe a 10-year-old has the attention span to read one page, but maybe a 7-year-old does not. So they now do all their briefings in half a page. All of North Korea in half a page. People used to joke that Barack Obama was too deliberate, that he took too much time, that he was too intellectual, that he would study positions for hours on end before making a decision. He was too deliberate. We don't have that problem anymore. Half a page. And the media reports are that in Donald Trump's briefing books, the very beginning of it is filled with praise for Donald Trump. Oh, here are all the articles that praised you, Donald. They may be 10% in the nation, but we're not going to read to you the other 90%. Here's another letter from an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old child, someone who's on your wavelength, saying how much he, it always seems to be a he, loves you. Oh, here are positive portrayals on Breitbart about your rallies. It seems that this man cannot get enough yes-manism. But in that atmosphere, it doesn't really account for problem-solving, particularly solving a difficult problem. How do you solve a problem like North Korea? Sorry, Sound of Music. But North Korea is more difficult than Maria. What should we do? And what are we to think of the president's comments, and how will this play out down the road? I welcome your comments. Give me a call, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back, right after this.
And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. How do you solve a problem like North Korea? And is Donald Trump making things worse by, not discussing anything with his generals and promising fire and fury like the world has never seen? President Theodore Roosevelt once said, you need to speak softly and carry a big stick. Don't overpromise, don't overmake threats. Carry your big stick, let them know that you're powerful. Be ready to attack if you must, but that the threat of attack is better than threatening an attack you won't carry out. Speak softly, carry a big stick. Our president, of course, does the opposite. He speaks very, very loudly. and annoyingly and incessantly. And he uses, well, what for him are big words. They're actually very small words, fire and fury. I mean, they're only four-letter words. But they create big import. He speaks loudly and he carries a very small stick. And no, I'm not referring to the size of his hands. I mean, he's really showing very little power. No one believes him. No one thinks his words have any meaning. Speaking loudly and carrying a small stick is exactly the opposite of good negotiation, because you threaten no one and you might just start something accidental. Let's go to the lines, 888-488. Mark, Michael from the Bronx, Old Faithful on line 3. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hey, good buddy. You know something? What we have here is a battle between two highly dangerous yet very juvenile mental case egos, in which the ones that get hurt in the end are the people from each of those nations. Now, the thing with the United States, as you quoted Roosevelt, is that all in all, the meaning is we are supposed to be on the defensive, not on the offensive. And the way Trump is going around, or should I call Mr. 45, is that he's completely on the offensive, and he's really uttering dangerous rhetoric. And if nobody believes that, all you have to do is go back to the campaign, which he incited violence, and even the courts have stated that he's incited violence in his rallies. Then after becoming president, it's the same stuff going on, even just recently at a police address in Long Island, when he's encouraging police brutality.
Right.
And then now this, I mean,
come I'll tell on. You, to me, Donald Trump is the boy who's crying wolf, right? I mean, he is arguing that Mexicans are rapists. He's talking about grabbing women by their private parts. He is blaming military insecurity on transgender folk. He's attacking Americans. He's attacking his own party. He's attacking, of course, he's attacking Hillary Clinton. He's attacking everybody so much that when we get to a real attack, a real wolf, a real danger, which North Korea is, well, the boy cries wolf and nobody comes anymore, because the boy's been calling everybody a wolf. If everybody's evil, then how do we deal with real evil and real danger? Go ahead.
But you know what's so scary, Mark, is that when I had mentioned about the campaign trail and his inciting violence then, we sure as hell saw his supporters engaging in such violence just from his rhetoric. We've seen the same thing with police officers.
Right. Now, I hear you, Michael. It's a separate issue, but it is a very important one, and one I've discussed before. I got to take a break. If you want to call in, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Toll-free number, 888-488-MARK. 888-488-6275, talking about North Korea. Some of the people I've been broadcasting to on Facebook, and by the way, I do broadcast on Facebook now. It doesn't always go as I want it to, but it works most of the time. You can just go to facebook.com/MarkLevineTalk, and you can watch me as well as hearing me. One of the people writes, this is Phil Yuley, writes, I think the best approach is to ignore the nuclear threats. He, meaning Kim Jong-un, he would never carry them out, as he knows annihilation will be the result. Also, his senior leadership would never allow him to push that button. You know, I don't know, Phil. I think you're right. I hope you're right. I expect you're probably right. But even if you're only, or even if you are 99% right, a 1% threat of this kind of threat is obviously a very, very severe one. It's true, annihilation would be the result for himself and for his country, and I think he does want to live, and even Bill Clinton made that clear. It seems unlikely that he would do a first threat against the United States. I'm not so sure it's because his leadership would never allow him to push that button. Remember how he killed his uncle. I mean, You know, it's a question of dying now or dying later. I don't know what would happen. I don't know that necessarily everyone knows where the missiles are pointed. But it's true that I think Kim Jong-un wants to survive. He wants to survive and continue to be the dictator of North Korea, continue to have the great power that he has, continue to destroy the lives of his own people he continues to destroy. The other part that you say, I completely agree with you, though. You say we should focus on perfecting our anti-ICBM ground-based mid-course defense missile shield, which has been shown to work in trials. We know that, for example, Israel has managed to put forward Patriot missiles that are pretty successful these days. They weren't initially, but now they're doing much better in knocking out missiles. And it's not like, well, it's not like he's Russia, where he's got hundreds and hundreds of missiles. Right now he has relatively few. It takes a lot of time for a missile. Unlike Israel, which has sometimes seconds to respond, we would have a full 30 minutes to track a missile heading for something like the West Coast. So, yes, I do think missile defense is a good idea. Phil goes on to say, we concomitantly implement a total embargo on North Korea, while assuring them we are not looking for regime change, just denuclearization. Our focusing too much on their nuclear capabilities, Phil writes, is playing into their hands and setting an example for other tin-pot dictators to follow. I do think we've set an example for tin-pot dictators to follow. We asked Saddam Hussein to give up his nukes, and he did. And then, we asked Muammar Gaddafi to give up nuclear weapons, or at least weapons of mass destruction, I should say, chemical, biological weapons. He did, and then we proceeded to take him out. More recently, Ukraine was promised by Russia that if it gave up its weapons, and we signed a deal, we, Russia, the United States and Russia and Great Britain and Ukraine signed a deal that if Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons, then all of its territory, including Crimea, would remain inviolate. Ukraine gave away its trump card, sorry to use that word, of nuclear weapons, and lo and behold, Putin invaded Ukraine, took Crimea, took portions of eastern Ukraine, and the United States and Great Britain didn't hardly do anything. So I think today, unfortunately, rogue states or even relatively peaceful democratic states like Ukraine get nuclear weapons in order to protect themselves. It's seen as the ultimate protection. And whether you're a good country or a bad country, whether you are a proto-democracy like Ukraine, or whether you're the United States or England or France, or whether you are a renegade, dangerous, totalitarian dictatorship like North Korea, nuclear weapons are seen as a way to keep you from being invaded. Kim Jong-un is using them to consolidate power. Certainly, it's not to make the people of North Korea better off. North Korea has very few paved roads. North Korea has starvation. North Korea has massive, massive prison camps, some of the largest in the world, where people grow up and die and spend their entire lives in such a camp. But the reason he has them is because he wants some kind of protection. That doesn't mean, though, that he can't threaten us with them. The question is, what do we do about it? I want to hear a little bit from you folks, and I'll give you an idea that I actually first proposed on the air in, I think, 2003 or 2004. It was just after. I've been on radio a long time, folks. A lot of people don't realize that. I've been on air since June of 2003. So I've been on the air more than 14 years. And in fact, one of my first shows dealt with North Korea because North Korea had just developed nuclear weapons. They didn't have the missiles yet, but they just had the nuclear weapons. And I proposed a plan then, don't know if anyone was still around then, that I will propose in a few moments on the air and curious to see what you think about it. I don't think it's a liberal or progressive plan, nor is it a conservative plan. I just think it's maybe a necessary self-defense measure. But I'll talk about that. First, I want to hear a little bit from you folks. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Let's go to Reggie in Georgia on line one. Hey, Reggie, how are you?
How you doing? Happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you, Reggie.
Happy Friday to you guys, too. I would just like to know, why do people like us such as Donald Trump, who like so many of these conservative right-wing radio TV talk shows, like us such as those on Fox News, try to act and act sound and be tough by... And even looked up by hiding behind podiums, microphones, or in front of TV cameras, but they're actually, like most bullies, they're actually but mere cowards. I mean, talking and acting tough, but yet they, whenever they confront people personally, they become like little, well, bitches, if you know what I mean.
Well, like I said, we have a man who is speaking loudly and carrying a small stick. It's not clear what he plans to do. I mean, you can threaten all kinds of things. I'll tell you, Donald Trump reminds me of no one so much as Baghdad Bob. Do you remember Baghdad Bob? This was in the early days of the Iraq War. And there was some Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein lackey, who said that we're going to fight the mother of all battles. And people mocked him, right? They said, what are you talking about? The United States we may have trouble occupying Iraq, but taking it in the first place is not that hard for our troops. That's who he reminds me of. We now have Baghdad Don. We've got, Mar-a-Lago or New Jersey Don. I have to think of another name for him, but it's just somebody mouthing off. And it's not like the United States doesn't have tremendous power. Of course we do. But it would seem to me that you develop a plan and you figure out what you're doing before you simply bluff and brag about U.S. power. Because it sounded like Donald Trump is saying, I dare you. I dare you, Kim Jong-un. You know, go ahead. Bomb Guam. I'll get you. And that's just not a smart thing to do. Anyway, go ahead, Reggie. Oh. Reggie's gone. All right. Toll-free number, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Colin, if you like, we'll take your calls. When we come back, I want to tell you my own idea that I actually thought of 14 years ago for how, if I were president, I would deal with North Korea. You may not like it, but remember, we don't have a lot of good choices. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. How do you solve a problem like North Korea? It would be easy just to say it's unsolvable. There are no good answers. That may well be true. But when you are a policymaker, when you're president of the United States, it's up to you to come up with a plan. Sometimes you have to make the best plan out of, well, some hard choices. The problem we've had in Korea, really dating back to the Korean War, is that even though we succeeded in freeing the southern part of Korea, we never freed the north. The Chinese came in, defended the North Koreans, and we battled them to a stalemate along the line that separates the two countries today. And North Korea always had a much bigger army than South Korea. South Korea spent its time focusing on technology, focusing on, frankly, changing their system of government from being more of a dictatorship to being a very vibrant democracy. I've been to South Korea. I was there almost 20 years ago now, in the late 90s, and saw very hardworking people, an extremely vibrant economy. South Korea is succeeding, one of the strongest economies on the planet. North Korea is one of the weakest ones. But every bit of resources they have, they devote into their military, as you might expect in a police state. And maybe their military would fall apart if there were war. Let's hope so, if there is a war. But basically, the fear was that North Korea could always overwhelm South Korea with conventional weapons. So the reason we have stationed American troops there, and we've had troops there since the 1950s, is to be sort of a tripwire, recognizing that because, well, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is less than an hour from the border, they could invade and pretty quickly and do a lot of damage. And with that American tripwire, it was understood that it would draw America into the war. And that actually is a good thing. You might say, what, Mark, drawing America into a war? How is that a good thing? It's a good thing because it serves as a deterrent. Same thing's true of NATO. NATO has kept the peace. They have not invaded a NATO country. There's a reason why Russia invaded Ukraine, but did not invade Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. It's because NATO says that, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance says that if one country is invaded, we all defend each other. Invading Latvia would draw the United States into a war. So would invading South Korea. But the concern is that, yes, that North Korean troops could overwhelm South Korean troops in a conventional war. And now that North Korea has nuclear weapons, the concern is, well, that North Korea can truly threaten its neighbors in ways it never has before. Now, after World War II, we purposely made Japan a non-nuclear nation. It said in their constitution, which we wrote as the victors of World War II. And certainly Japan does not lack nuclear weapons because they lack intelligence or industry or technological skill. I'm quite confident that Japanese could develop nuclear weapons very, very quickly if they wanted to. But they haven't, and we've kept the peace. That's been our deal, and that's largely been our deal with South Korea as well. And that's why, until 10 years ago, Korea was a denuclearized peninsula. Still a very dangerous totalitarian dictatorship, brutal government in the north, but at least it didn't have nuclear weapons. So here's my proposal. Again, it may sound strange coming from a progressive like me, but these are difficult times. So, Mr. President, I doubt you're listening to me, but other policymakers, generals, listen up. I'm going to tell you the same thing I said on air more than 10 years ago. Here's what I would do if I were president. And I can announce it publicly because I'm not president. First thing I would do if I were president is I would get those sanctions against North Korea. Absolutely. I would work on that publicly. I would work to do a very public, strong sanctions, including sanctions on anyone doing business with North Korea, which includes a lot of Chinese companies. I would absolutely do that. But secretly in the background, I would actually put nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles, with the, of course, the approval of the South Korean government, in American hands on South Korean soil. And I would do it quietly, take some time to set that up, and get them ready to go. And then, after they're set up, in 3 months, 6 months, I would announce it publicly. Once they're set up and ready to go, announce that they're there. And say to North Korea, okay, now both Koreans have nukes. We don't like it. We will make a deal, though. You disable your nukes, South Korea will disable its nukes. And I would keep it in the hands of the American military, just to be safe, just so they're under our control. Again, I don't like this. I don't think it's pleasant. But sometimes deterrence means you have to show a certain force of will. That way, we don't have to wait till a missile comes towards Los Angeles. The South Koreans would know that any attack on them is an attack that they could respond to. Now, I don't like this. I want to be very clear. I'm not promoting nuclear weapons. To me, this is a way to actually get deterrence. It's a way to say, all right, now that they both Koreas have nuclear weapons, you can work and negotiate to get them down. But otherwise, I fear that Kim Jong-un will continue to bully his neighbors, will take this very prosperous democracy and American ally, South Korea, and continue to force their way. Now, note, I wouldn't say anything. I would speak softly. But this would be the big stick we'd have in the background. And then, again, once they're there, I'd announce them. China wouldn't like that either. China wouldn't like South Korea having nuclear weapons. China, of course, has nuclear weapons as well. China, I think, would value a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. And then I could see four-party talks. United States, China, South Korea, and North Korea, all four at the table. working on everyone removing their nuclear weapons. Anyway, that's my proposal. I don't know if we're doing it. I hope we are. I kind of doubt it, though, because I would think if we had done it, we would have done it back in, well, in 04, 05, when I first suggested it, under the Bush administration or under the Obama administration. But if someone's listening to my voice, think about it. It's not a perfect solution. None of them are. But rather than speaking loudly and carrying a small stick, let's speak softly and carry a big one. Let's make sure that our allies can defend themselves. Ironically, if we don't put nuclear weapons in South Korea, in my view, there will be a nuclear arms race. Only we won't be in control of it, and we won't be a part of it. Japan will feel the need to do it. South Korea may want to do it on its own. I could imagine Taiwan with nuclear weapons, and not to mention a whole host of governments, some friendly and some unfriendly. Saudi Arabia is probably on its way to getting nuclear weapons. And then let's not even go to rogue states, right? There's a whole host of dangerous states. I mean, Iran was trying to develop nuclear weapons, as we know. We don't need a nuclear arms race. Ironically, though, weapons under our control, I think, could tampen it down. So, I don't know. That's my solution. It's not much of one. I admit that. And I certainly, if you have problems with it and you want to call in at 888-48-MARK, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let me know what you think. But I do know that simply bluster is never going to solve the problem. Simply talking big is not the answer. And this is where it really gets scary, having Donald Trump. I mean, I am frightened by Donald Trump's domestic agenda. I am nervous when he is telling police to harm people that they are putting in their vans who are at the moment innocent until proven guilty. When he talks about using his vote commission in order to shut down voting across the nation, in order to prevent people from voting, that's extremely dangerous. And even more dangerous than Donald Trump is his supporters. A recent poll showed that a majority of Republicans would support Donald Trump, get this, if he said that due to the crises of the time, he would postpone the 2020 elections. Now, I think people were just telling the pollster crazy stuff just to annoy the pollster. I can't believe that even my fellow Americans, Republicans, would want to end the American constitutional experiment, to end the republic, to end democracy. But we have real threats at home caused by this man. He's remaking the American judiciary. He's taking away judges who care about constitutional rights and putting in these ideologues that are trying to make billionaires get a lot of power. And meanwhile, of course, the Donald is profiting. He and his family are making $10 million a year off the U.S. government, at least, from his hotels, from his charge in the Secret Service, from everything else. As long as he remains just a corrupt con man, he can only swindle us for tens of millions of dollars. And that would be very minor compared to the real dangers of a possible nuclear exchange. That's not something that can even be joked about. It's something that a good president, Democrat or Republican, would take seriously. Sorry to have such a sober topic, but I hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back on Monday for another edition of The Inside Scoop.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. I deal with a lot of criminal types, and lately, more of them are identity thieves, because identity theft is one of the fastest growing crimes in America. So let's hear how they do it.
Identities are easy to catch online. I just go fishing for them. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Hooks them every time.
Stealing folks' identity is as easy as